every month.
She's almost she's almost like a coworker. What would you like to say?
If you guys want to follow our drive, we do have a Facebook page. Look up USW Cast Products Employees. We update that very many times a day.
Okay. And you also have information on the website.
IndivisibleOR.org or Facebook, Indivisible Oregon. And also we have a very snarky Twitter feed at Indivisible_OR.
Okay. So I think we're finishing up things and we'll wrap it up. Thank you all for being here. It's
Thanks
very important work you
Thanks
all
for
do.
Having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio. To you, the 9-to-5-er.
KABU Community Radio is requesting proposals for a grant writer to provide ongoing grant writing services and application support. This is a one-year contract position for 200 hours, compensated at $25 an hour. Proposals must be submitted electronically to Delphine Crescenzo, station manager at Dell, that's D-E-L, at KABU.FM. Proposals are due Friday, January 4th at 5 p.m. Responsibilities, background information, the scope of work, and proposal requirements can be found at kabu.fm/grantwriter2018. KABU Community Radio is requesting proposals.
That's right. KABU is. And you are listening to KABU right now. It is 6:31 and time for Prison Pipeline.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Hi, welcome to Prison Pipeline. Today we are on the phone with Jeannie Alexander of the No Exceptions Harriet Tubman community. Welcome, Jeannie.
Hi, thank you.
Jeannie, can you tell us a little bit about the No Exceptions Harriet Tubman House? Is that the correct way to title it?
Well, actually, there are two separate, and they're connected but also separate. So No Exceptions Prison Collective is a collective. It's an organization that actually came out of prison. The idea of it, the focus areas, all came from insiders and my initial work behind prison walls. And then I left a position as a head chaplain at a prison in 2014, resigned that. I resigned that in order to start No Exceptions Prison Collective on the outside of the walls. Harriet Tubman House is an community. It is an interfaith community, and the folks who are residents here, everyone is basically a full-time advocate, is focused on this work of dismantling the PIC, the prison industrial complex. And there are members that are both former insiders and then people who have never been on the inside, but all committed to the same goals. And so this is, it's not just, so No Exceptions, I guess you would have to say, it's not like this is just my work. This is this is our way of being in the world.
Right.
And it is an abolitionist way of being in the world, because some things can't be reformed. Does that help?
Yes. How does living collectively in a community, I mean, that's kind of unique in prison abolition work from most of the people I know. So what are some of the benefits of living in community? How did that come about?
Well, and it's interesting. I think some of the benefits are that if you're living in a community and if you're living collectively, I want to choose my words carefully so they're as accurate as possible. This life is amazing, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. And it is also constant, and it can be exhausting. And when you are living with people who are dedicated to the same values and goals that you are, that really helps to strengthen your resolve and your intention. It helps to clarify your thinking and where you're going, and to be able to work with people who are dedicated to the same things you are and are dedicated to another vision of the world than the one we're currently living in. You make that vision real every day by living it, you know, and not just talking about it and not having it as theory, but showing how people can live in community, right, and collectively, and share resources. And, you know, you don't have to be well-funded by government grants, you know, or you know, through some other sort of funding, you know, that you can live collectively and live in an economy of grace and engage directly in the praxis. And so that makes it what can be a very difficult life, sometimes very challenging, very heavy spiritually and emotionally, and it makes it also beautiful, you know? I mean, when you see it every day, you see that new possible reality.
And so your community is interfaith, and it's also composed of insiders and advocates. Is that correct?
Right. So everyone, former insiders or not, you know, I mean, so I would say that there are certainly collective members behind the walls. You know, that's important. And they are non-resident. So there are resident members, and then there are broader community members, broader collective members. And we're like actually in a renovation process right now to increase the numbers of people who are going to be resident members with plans of future expansion. So yeah, there are current insiders, former insiders, and then folks who are advocates who have never been on the inside. Mm-hmm. And we come with the different skill sets. You know, we have, my background is in law and theology, so former attorneys and ministers, people who have done mitigation, have done restorative justice work. We have writers and journalists, and we just have a wide variety. And then, you know, and we have the ability to, quite frankly, in disrupting and challenging the system, our abilities differ in the amount of risk we could take, right? So, for example, community members who are former insiders, who maybe are on parole indefinitely or something, they can't take risks of being arrested at direct actions or something like that. And so they don't, and they aren't expected to, right? They've served their time behind the walls, and that's the last place we want them to go again. And they are able to function in community in a lot of other ways, you know?
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. So, Jeannie, can you tell me a little bit about your work prior to starting the No Exceptions Prison Collective and Harriet Tubman House?
Mm-hmm, sure. So, I like the practice of law to go back to grad school for theology and began working in some jails. And the first time I ever went to a prison to do some volunteer work, it was on Georgia's death row in Jackson. And the first prisoner I ever met was Troy Davis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That was my introduction to prison, was meeting Troy. And what I understood upon that initial meeting was that everything I thought I understood about prison and prisoners was absolutely wrong. You know, I mean, lawyers are really smart, and I went to really good law school, and people could have a tendency to be arrogant and think, oh, yeah, I know what to expect. I've got this figured out. I didn't know anything. And that really began my real education process. And I never expected to actually go to work as a prison chaplain. I mean, I went in as a death penalty abolitionist. I was opposed to mass incarceration. And I was hired, and I was actually approached by guys on death row in Tennessee, once I moved to Tennessee and began volunteering at a prison here, their chaplain was retiring, and they came to me and said, you have to apply for this job and take it. And their words were, who is going to protect us if you aren't here? And the idea was that they said a chaplain has the ability to create programs and bring in volunteers, and they believe that if you can bring people in from the outside, because prison walls are really constructed as much to keep people out as keep people in, because the prison industrial complex wants to keep our society ignorant of what's really happening behind those walls. And these guys knew, if you bring people in, then they're going to know that we aren't monsters, that we aren't a threat to them, and this structure doesn't have to exist in the way that it does. And so I ended up taking the position, and I was shocked that I was hired. You know, I went in completely honest about my politics and about the fact that I'd been arrested for civil disobedience and was hired nonetheless. And I tell people I went in as a death penalty abolitionist and came out as a prison abolitionist. yeah. And so that was my work. And I was there for about 5 years, which was amazing. And during that time, we were able to create some amazing programs and like double our volunteers until the prison became, you know, we had a shift in prison culture, I would say, in Tennessee that became increasingly hostile to volunteers and programs, and adopted a militaristic model of prison, which they imported from Georgia. And that's been a disaster since it occurred. And we are continuing down the spiral now where we have simply replicated that model. And back recently, like some of the work we're running a campaign to bring back in-person visitation in the jails here, particularly starting with Knox County, because we believe absolutely that where this is headed is to end in-person visitation in prison, which means you literally disappear someone. Like, mm-hmm. It could be for 5, 20, or a lifetime. And that person has been converted to a pure commodity as far as the system is concerned.
Is that something that's happening? I mean, we're out here on the West Coast, so, mm-hmm. but I was just yesterday, I was interviewing Paul Wright, also for Prison Pipeline, and he was talking about the monetization of incarceration and how, you know, some of the prisons now are doing this thing where you can't actually visit a person physically. You can only talk to them over the video. And then now they're starting to charge to talk to them over the video, like $1 a minute. And
I mean, that model is fully implemented. Yeah. And no, that's exactly right. That's happening here in the South too. And so when we did our initial survey, we thought, okay, it looks like about 15% of the jails have moved to, and not prisons, but jails, you know, have moved to video-only visitation. And the way they introduce this into the system is they say, look, this is going to be great if you have loved ones who can't afford to travel, or they are too ill to see you, or just, you know, and it's going to make it easier for you to visit. And it's only an option. You know, you're still going to have face-to-face if that's what you want. And then every single time they eliminate face-to-face, they charge for the video visitation. So yes, it is totally the monetization of that. And that's all done completely contrary to all the social science. Even the ACA, the American Correctional Association, advises against elimination of in-person visitation. It makes prisons and jails more dangerous. Because, I mean, what do you have to lose, right? If you can't even see or touch someone you care about and love at that point, I mean, that's one of the things we've been able to track, is that violent incidents go up in jails where you eliminate in-person visitation.
Mm-hmm.
And it also does not cut down on contraband, which is the argument that is always used. Well, we're short-staffed, and so it's harder to run visitation, and also we've got this contraband. Mm-hmm. Well, anyone who knows anything about prison and jails knows that the majority of contraband overwhelmingly is coming in through employees. And the reason they can't keep employees is because our systems have degraded to such a point and are so dehumanizing that it's completely undeniable that it's also dehumanizing to people who work there. So, of course, they can't keep up sufficient numbers to staff prisons and jails. It doesn't work for anybody.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that that was happening to you when you were a prison chaplain? Was that process happening to you, that dehumanization you're talking about?
You know, Foucault writes about this, you know, and kind of the inevitability of this. And I was on guard constantly because I was like, okay, I know this will happen. And even with somebody who was there openly as an advocate for prisoners, it's exhausting and it wears on you. And where I really saw it, not so much within myself, I didn't have this realization one day that, oh my God, you know, I'm beginning to dehumanize people too. What was actually happening to me was, through my education and being from the inside of the system and viewing it, was that, good God, this is the most unbelievable dystopia that exists, that, I mean, and it is actually functioning within our society and people don't even know it. I was just increasingly appalled by what I saw, mm-hmm. and increasingly convinced that this has to stop, that mm-hmm. that this is a human rights disaster. But I saw things, and what I did see is I did witness the fact that it is dehumanizing to the people who work there, in all capacities, but particularly security, you know, with guards, correctional officers. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I mean, that's no secret. You know, when Norway had this radical shift of culture and change in prison policies and the way they even conceived of what this prison's for, you know, this, all of that started because they realized that the prisons weren't just killing prisoners, that they were killing their employees too. They discovered that prisoners with like a life sentence and career correctional officers both had a life expectancy of 50. And they thought, holy crap, what's happening here? And as they began investigating, they understood that this very harsh, retributive model of prisons kills everybody that is in that. It is a toxic environment.
Mm-hmm. So the Harriet Tubman House where you and your community mm-hmm. live, you said they're interfaith. How does the interfaith aspect play a role in supporting and nurturing your work as a prison abolitionist?
Yeah. I think the role that that plays for all of us, I could say, is that all of this work is driven ultimately for us by love, right? And in defiance of a system that would seek to crush humans, to create a myth about them, to rob people of their inherent dignity and worth, because we believe everyone maintains that. And we could never fight this hard just to dismantle something. We're fighting this hard to create something new, you know? Mm-hmm. And fighting this hard because there are men and women, there are husbands and sons and daughters and mothers and grandmothers behind those bars that are being crushed every day. And their lives have value. And what our prison culture wants us to do now to pacify people is to say, oh, just focus on reentry, or, oh, let's just focus on school to prison pipeline, you know, to the extent they ever give it lip service. That way we want to make sure people are set to come back into the community, or we keep them out to begin with. But they don't ever actually want to keep anyone out of the prison pipeline. And our sentences are so long, so many people aren't coming home, you know. And we just believe that we can't leave people behind. Mm-hmm. And when our focus is on prison, it's because these are the camps that have been built in our country, and they're just going to expand their franchise, so to speak, of carceral slavery and continue to fill those camps. And so we have to stop that most immediate evil. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be this way. Mm-hmm. There are ways that if someone presents a true danger to a community, that they could be socially segregated for a period of time. But we believe that the end result, because we believe in the value of human life, see, I would say that we are radically pro-life because we believe so deeply in that value of human life, is that every life is worth caring about and understanding what has happened. Like, crime doesn't happen in a vacuum, right? Mm-hmm. A violent offense doesn't happen in a vacuum. Murder doesn't happen in a vacuum. Something has disrupted the fabric of not just an individual, but community, and really seeing the impact. And it just seems so counterintuitive to warehouse millions of people when we could say, how do we heal people and heal communities so that the goal is to return people to a community as healthy as possible, right? Mm-hmm. To make the communities stronger. Our communities aren't stronger by removing people forever. Mm-hmm. Our communities are stronger when we heal people. Mm-hmm. And that's hard, messy work. You know, that's not touchy-feely, fuzzy bunny crap. That's hard work. Mm-hmm. And our system would rather just take the easy and very economically lucrative route of warehousing people that it doesn't desire anyway and considers surplus labor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you just said really touched me, especially about how it disrupts the fabric of our entire community. That's just really, really true.
I mean, look at gentrification, right? One of the ways that gentrification is able to exist and it happens is because of our carceral state, because of increased sentences. I mean, sentences across the board, you know, people who would normally own homes and neighborhoods and communities, they can't do that. I mean, their families have been torn apart. Communities have been so disrupted that people are far more likely to be renters now, you know, mm-hmm. Particularly in targeted minority
communities. Or homeless.
Yes, or homeless. Mm-hmm. And so then you have investors who are owning the majority of those homes, and they come in, and as soon as people want to come back into urban areas, they'll sell those homes at an incredibly high profit, and it's literally destroying communities. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we see it in Nashville, right? The destruction of historically Black communities here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're having the same conversation here in Portland. Mm-hmm.
And do you see the same thing there?
Exactly the same thing.
Well? Because mm-hmm. we've seen like this blight. I mean, there's just, what do you have in the middle of nowhere? You have a prison and a Dollar General mm-hmm. here. And that's the plan for the economy of rural Tennessee, which is no plan at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if your plan to make people economically secure is to invest in the destruction of lives, then mm-hmm. you've got a plan of death. That's all you've got.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about some of the current campaigns that your collective or that the Harriet Tubman are working on?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure. So, like I mentioned a while ago, we've got a current campaign to bring back in-person visitation in Knox County, starting in Knox, in Tennessee. But we've got a situation now where over half of our counties have eliminated in-person. So it's much bigger than Knoxville.
Wow.
Yeah, over half. And when the national average is about 15%, and that's what we expected to find. Okay, well, probably 15% of Tennessee jails have done this. Well, no, it's over half. So we are in a very serious.
Is that common? People, is that common throughout? Is that something that's like a regional trend? Is it something that's just happening in the South? Because I didn't know this was so commonplace.
I think the acceleration from what we're seeing is really happening in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, this is what you'd expect. I mean, we live in a state where we couldn't pass a resolution in our General Assembly to condemn white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a Southern thing, but it's a model that's spreading. So there's mm-hmm. there's that campaign. We're working on a campaign to, and this is one instance when I would use the R reform word, reform life sentences in Tennessee. Life with parole, the national average is 25 years. And that's what it was in Tennessee prior to the mid-90s with truth and sentencing laws.
Mm-hmm.
So 1995 onward, life with parole in Tennessee is 51 calendar years, period. Mm. It's a death sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So we may have, you know, whatever, 64 people on death row right now, but in reality, we literally have thousands of people in the state with a death sentence because mm-hmm. we have that death penalty. We have life without parole, but then our life with is definitely a death sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And again,
which is so far, I mean, we talk about that here on the collective, and I also talk about it with people that I work with, that, you know, the real measure of when somebody should come out is like when they've reached a point where they can acknowledge or understand what they did and how it impacted the people around them, and then taken the steps to, you know, to heal themselves from the trauma that they created and that also got them to where they are. And I'm with most people, totally. That's like about 7 years at the most.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what Norway has found, right? So their mm-hmm. maximum sentence now is 21 years. Well, they have a 21-year determinant and an indeterminate, but the goal is to get people out before then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, and people say, and people ask us all the time, good God, you started trying to reform first-degree murder? You know, that sentence? And our answer is yes. Those folks are the ones who have the lowest recidivism rates. Like mm-hmm. murder is a very unique crime, and they also cause the most to incarcerate. because the cost of incarceration doubles when someone hits what would be considered geriatric in prison, which is only about 50 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there's every good reason in the world to do it. But again, we keep running up against this emotional wall of people, oh, no, we're going to have to stay tough on crime, and these people deserve this, and it's this totally retributive mentality. But that mentality is really being fed by the corporate structure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our prison industrial complex is not at all a function of trying to keep people safe. I mean, as you all know, I mean, this is a capitalist monster that's been built,
mm-hmm.
and it's devouring people
mm-hmm.
and making a certain segment of people incredibly wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so then we had the life sentences campaign about in-person visitation. We also organized a class action lawsuit here, and we were able to bring in other organizations and law firms to bring a class action on behalf of prisoners who have hepatitis C.
Mm-hmm.
So when that suit was filed, we knew there were about 4,000 people that the system knew about that TDOC, the Department of Correction, recognized as having hep C, even though they don't do universal testing, so we know it's much higher, but there were 4,000 and 8 were receiving treatment.
Medical neglect.
So, so our focus area is just like shortly our says life sentences, and so sentencing reform. And so it will go beyond the life sentences once we're successful there. Internal conditions, which largely but not only includes medical care, mostly the lack thereof, and then also the abolition of private prison.
Yeah,
we believe there is no place,
mm-hmm.
no place in any society for private prisons.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a third plank of our focus area. And we have ongoing. This summer, we've got a campaign called Break the Block, because we refer to, like, CCA, for example, like the largest slave auction block.
CCA is the Corrections Corporation of America?
Mm-hmm. Which has been rebranded as Core Civic, but there's nothing core or civic about it, in our opinion. So,
mm-hmm.
CCA.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a campaign of awareness and education, and also direct action.
Wow.
And we think that the work requires, you know, legislation, litigation, grassroots organizing, and also increased direct action. Because we operate in a state where the General Assembly is disinclined, you know, to
mm-hmm.
make substantive changes. You know, and so Flannery O'Connor said, and I'm going to paraphrase, that for those who are blind and deaf, you have to create these large images and shout very loudly.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're becoming increasingly creative and collaborative and creating large, shocking images and shouting very loudly.
Wow. Well, Jeannie, we only have a couple of minutes left. First of all, can you tell me if people want to get in touch with you or learn more about the No Exceptions Collective or about Harriet Tubman House,
mm-hmm.
Where can they go to learn about that?
Sure. So from a social media, I'm terrible at tweeting. I just don't keep up with it. But I would say go to Facebook. So we have you can go to the Harriet Tubman House on Facebook to that page,
mm-hmm.
and to also No Exceptions Prison Collective on that page as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have a website, noexceptions.net. And I would say just don't forget the S on the end of exceptions.
Okay.
And those are probably the best ways to get in touch with us.
Thanks. So in our last minute or two, can you just tell me what gives you hope?
I believe in the inevitability of love and freedom. I believe that there is some notion, I don't care what anybody calls it, of justice that isn't a justice about retribution. And I believe that there's a struggle to get there. And I think that it's worth giving my life to. And I see it, and I have hope because I see that truth and that beauty and that dignity every day in the people that I work with. And as we're trying to struggle and change, and that's what gives me hope. It may seem absurd to some people, but I feel it moving, and I feel a shift in our culture, and I think that's part of what's happening right now. You know, this huge struggle, and I think it's a really old war that's been going on for a long time, and I genuinely believe we're on the right side of that.
I have to have hope. Thank you. So we've been talking with Jeannie Alexander from the No Exceptions Prison Collective and also Harriet Tubman House, which is a unique community in Nashville, Tennessee, that's dedicated to insiders, former insiders and advocates living together in an interfaith community, working to abolish the prison industrial complex. Jeannie, thank you so much for joining us on Prison Pipeline.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad,
...2018 is coming to a close, and we know that community radio is more important than ever.
You are the number one reason KBOO exists and can broadcast programming that is not driven by for-profit interests.
KBOO provides a platform for musicians, alternative perspectives, real news, and meaningful programming made by the people, for the people.
We set a big goal to raise $38,000 by the end of the year, and we are proud to announce that we are almost there.
We have just a little while left to finish strong and celebrate a successful 2018.
You know that your voice matters and that KBOO is the resource we need to gather, connect, and make the movement.
Donate today to make sure we meet the $38,000 goal. We are so close and we need you right now.
Go to kboo.fm/give to contribute now.
Support KBOO. Tune in.
And turn up.
On Monday, December 31st at 8 p.m. to celebrate the late night programmers and the Night Owl community of KBOO as the last event of our 50th anniversary year.